Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. It seems to come with being human that we, each of us, are aware of a self in our system, an I or a me behind our eyes, a mind that must be using our brain but is somehow different from it. This is the thinking self, identified by the first modern philosopher Descartes, himself a practicing scientist who dissected bodies looking for vision pathways and nerve connections. In the 17th century, Descartes decided that the pineal gland at the bottom of the brain must be the intersection of body and spirit, the place where messages get conducted from the physical to the abstractly mental and back. Most of four centuries later, the brain sciences know better than that about neural networks and the pineal gland, yet the mystery of locating and defining consciousness persists at that intersection of science and philosophy. In week 8 of our Summer Philosophy series, the question is just what's happened where philosophies of mind meet the cutting edge of neurobiology, the cognitive sciences. Connection listeners, have brain sciences swallowed up the mind-body question? Have they nailed it? The Mind-Body Philosophy Connection phone is 1-800-423-8255. Our guest, Patricia Churchland, is a philosopher in a hotbed of the cognitive sciences, University of California at San Diego. The giveaway title of her best-known book is Neurophilosophy. From the University of Iowa, the neuroscientist Antonio Damasio is the author of Descartes' Error and another book called The Feeling of What Happens. Connection listeners, if you've got a self beyond your body, if you've got a mind beyond your brain, call us up at 1-800-423-8255. The Philosophy of Mind Connection. Patricia Churchland, welcome to The Connection. I'd like you to begin by just answering why philosophers have such a problem with what we all know intuitively, that I'm an I and you're a you. There's something here beyond my body, I feel.
Well, I think the problem is not that we might not have such a thing, but the problem is really to understand how it is that neurons in a brain can make such a thing. How is it that they can be organized and structured and put together in such a way as to make something that can have focused attention, that can have a sense of self, that can have an autobiography and reason and use language and so forth. And, of course, the problem really began with the Greeks in about the 6th century B.C. And the Greeks, of course, were very interested in the nature of everything and how things worked. And it was really Hippocrates, I think, who began the tradition of thinking that there was probably a natural explanation for phenomena like emotions and reasoning and so forth. And he thought that indeed it was the brain that did these things, although of course he didn't have a real idea of how it was done. But I think the other kind of thread in the tradition has always been this, that many people have a real desire that there should be something that would survive the bodily death. And so we see really in the Christian era, the scientific naturalistic question about how these things such as thinking and reasoning can be produced by a brain, we see that really intertwined with questions about what it is that can be the thing that survives the bodily death. Now, as science has developed, particularly really in the later part of the 17th, 18th, and of course the 19th centuries, finally with the tremendous flowering of the neurosciences in the 20th century, it became really increasingly unlikely that there is such a thing as a non-physical soul that survives the bodily death, that Hippocrates really was right. Now, that's not known for sure, but that certainly is the way that the evidence lines up right now.
Stand by, Patricia Churchland. Antonio Damasio, I wonder if you can give us the short course in what the cognitive sciences have done to narrow the question of, you know, this mind-body mystery. The pineal gland question, sort of, where is the intersection? How have the brain sciences doped it out?
Well, I can give you the short course on my view of it.
Sure.
And the issue is certainly that Descartes was wrong in the way you just outlined in your introduction. I think that the idea of a mind that is separate from the body or from the brain, for that matter, is simply not correct as far as we can see. On the other hand, it was very interesting that you oppose that view to the idea that mind is just neurons in operation. And I don't think that that's true either in the narrow sense. It is, of course, coming from the activity of neurons, of many, many neurons organized in complex circuits, but it happens to be a little bit more than that, because the issue is not just having neurons in circuits performing certain operations. It's the fact that those operations are very complex, they're organized in a particular way. So there's something about the design of the operation that is the critical issue here. And also the fact that when we talk about the mind, certainly when we talk about our minds today, we have to figure in the account that there are certain phenomena that occur in very complex organisms in a social and cultural environment that do play a role in how that mind comes to be. Of course, it's very interesting that all of that hails from biological tissue. In other words, everything we have in terms of our organism, in terms of our mind, in terms of social and cultural phenomena, is based on the fact that we have living cells, living tissues, organs, and an organism working together. Mm. But in the end, something gets built outside of those organisms, especially when we have a collective of those organisms, that produces phenomena of its own and that interact back with those organisms, of course, through evolution to create what we have today as a mind. So let's say that Descartes, certainly in the narrow view, was wrong, and that our mind is based on the activity of biological tissue, but of biological tissue inserted in an environment that is, of course, not just physical, but also social and cultural. Hmm. And then I can tell you a little bit more about what I think in terms of the narrower part of the problem of mind, which preoccupies us all, philosophers such as Patricia and neuroscientists such as me, and that is the issue of consciousness.
Well, let's talk about it. You've used a lot of the words that, you know, there's so many words over the years out of different sort of scientific cultures that we use to describe the soul. People used to talk about humors, emotions, moods, consciousness, perspective, identity. A lot of them go back to Plato and the Christian tradition of a mind-body or body-soul separation. I wonder how have the cognitive sciences rewritten, or what have they contributed in the way of new language, new words, to understand what you think is actually happening? Patricia, could you fill us in on sort of a new vocabulary that matches modern scientific understanding to describe, you know, bad hair days or bright moods or deep depression or love or all of this kind of stuff, knowledge, selfhood? How would a scientist describe these things?
Well, I don't really think that we're at the point yet where we're getting redescriptions of very high-level phenomena. I think where we are is in understanding something about the chemical mediation that has an effect on circuitry that can do things like make you feel one way or another, or that can have an influence on such things as emotion and so forth. But it should be remembered that neuroscience is really very much still in its early stages, and that one of the important things I think that Antonio mentioned is that we aren't just sort of a pile of neurons, that what is increasingly evident about the nervous system is that it is incredibly organized, that there is tremendous systematicity, that if there is a mystery to be solved, it's going to be solved in the details of understanding the nature of that organization. Now, there's really much that we don't understand yet about how things are put together and how even relatively simple effects are produced, such as seeing visual motion, for example. And so my feeling is that in the fullness of time, we may come to understand in a rather different way something like a phenomenon like, say, attention, where it now looks like there are several systems mediating attention, meaning that there are probably several different kinds of attention. And they may come or may not come to be described in very different vocabulary. But that, I think, really remains to be seen. And at this stage...
But is it scientists or philosophers who are going to nail the question?
I think that it's a combination of people who are interested in the problem. It can't be done without experiment. It can't be done without data, that's for sure. At the same time, of course, it's evident that it's a problem where you also need sort of a theoretical framework. Where exactly that will come from, it's hard to say. I mean, it might come from a postal clerk.
But let me ask you both. I mean, there's a difference here. Patricia, you're a philosopher who sort of sees it happening in the neurons, puts mm-hmm. it in the brain process. Antonio Damasio is a scientist who sees it happening between somewhere the neurons and an abstraction. Should we call it design or this environment? Antonio, who's going to solve this problem? Has cognitive science swallowed philosophy, or is it still a philosophical question?
No, I agree with Patricia. It's going to be solved by a combination of efforts, and it really doesn't make any difference what you call the people that are involved in the solution. Obviously, you need to have empirical work. There's no way you're going to solve the problem if you don't have a theoretical frame, if you don't have proper hypotheses, and if you don't test them with scientific method. But then there's the issue that once you take a step back and look at what you found, you need to place that in a broader context. And traditionally, philosophy has had that role. Mm-hmm. Philosophy began by being a combination of what is now philosophy and what is now science. But I think philosophy has a role. So I don't think that scientists are going to put philosophers out of business. But I think Patricia is right. You know, you could be a postal clerk, provided the postal clerk reads our books.
Mm-hmm.
Antonio, I wish you'd sort of walk us into your lab here and show us how you would track down, as a cognitive scientist, some of these things we all experience. Patricia mentioned attention. Track down, say, sadness. Track down optimism. Track down beliefs, intentions. I want to know about my intentions, Dr. Damasio. Where in my neural pathway here can you find my intentions?
Well, I can't and I won't, and for the foreseeable future, we're not going to track that particular high level of mind and behavior. However, we can track very well certain phenomena that will be important to generate what you have just described as your intention. But, you know, in very simple terms, especially as far as human research is concerned, there are two main approaches right now. And one has been honored by time and really began with the beginning of neurology, which is also the beginning of neuroscience, and that is studying individuals who have had damage to their brains. You think about neurological conditions such as stroke, for example, which will damage a particular part of the brain. When that happens, provided you have a hypothesis about how you think a certain system is functioning to produce a certain phenomenon such as an emotion or the act of learning, then it is possible to test hypotheses about what that particular part of the brain was doing in the system. So that's one very important tradition. It is known as sort of the gold standard of neuroscience research in humans. It's known as the lesion method, and it is now very rich because we have amazing technological developments that allow us to look at the human brain, the living human brain, yours or mine, for instance, just the way that 100 years ago you would do at an autopsy table. The other has to do with functional imaging methods. Again, new marvels of technology that are not without their problems, but allow you to see how actual parts of the brain are operating within the period in which the person is performing a given task, such as learning a song or reciting a verse or what have you. So these two approaches combined in our laboratory and in many others allow us to go to these hypotheses and test them and find out if what we're thinking makes any sense.
Patricia Churchland, are these sort of the critical steps in cognitive science as you view it? I mean, the lesion method and this kind of closer dissection of learning a song process, say.
Well, clearly, clinical neurology and neuropsychology and the study of patients with lesions is tremendously important and will continue to be so. And Antonio is right. It provides a kind of gold standard. It provides a kind of framework within which we can then address questions about how memory works or how some aspect of visual perception works and so on. At the same time, of course, it's essential to know what's happening at the level of the neuron. If we're, for example, we want to understand learning, we need to know something about the circuitry involved, but we also need to understand the precise details of what happens when the structure changes to embody learning. And that turns out to be a most interesting story. Much of the details are still out of reach, but they're coming in. But it's very complicated and but highly, highly organized, connected with the genes. So gene expression is often involved in learning because that produces new proteins, which produces new changes in the structure. So we're very interested in structure at all levels, at the level of the shape of the proteins that make up the membranes of the neurons, of the nature of the neurons themselves, and of the organization of the circuitry and how that organizes itself into systems. And then we have the brain as a whole that's fitted into a body that it's very intimately connected with. And then, of course, the level of organization ultimately we're interested in is the cultural one. And as Antonio said, how cultural effects, cultural institutions, the embodiment of knowledge in culture also has an effect on brain and brain development and brain learning.
Well, you know,
can I just add one thing?
Sure. Let me just interrupt you and say the phone's 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the mind-body question in philosophy and in the cognitive sciences. Antonio Damasio.
Yeah, I was just going to say that these two sort of ends of the spectrum of approaches, the one that I outlined in relation to humans specifically and the one that Patricia just outlined in terms of the way individual cells and circuits operate, are really complementary, as she was suggesting. So what we the important thing is this. When you ask me about how will I know about the brain aspect of your state of sadness, right now I cannot do it at the level of a single cell, at the level of the gene expression in a single cell. However, there is work going on, and this is, of course, work that largely goes on in animal experimentation, that will one day, and the day is coming quite shortly and soon, be able to connect with the work that is going on at the human level. So you can expect in the next decades, and in some cases quite rapidly, a link that may be established, for instance, between certain genes and gene expression, the operation of certain circuits, and things that are really very complex that are going on in our brain, such as, for instance, having an emotion and having a feeling of that emotion.
Could I ask, Patricia, you said earlier that, you know, neuroscience makes it increasingly unlikely that there's a non-physical soul lurking in there, no ghost in the machine, you say. On the other hand, will we ever overcome the human intuition that there's something very peculiar that happens when sort of the light goes on, when you open your eyes, when you feel yourself in this human situation, that it wants to be described as an abstract consciousness, something like a soul.
Well, there certainly is a kind of representation of self. There is, of course, in the brain a body representation, and Antonio has had a lot to say about how body representation and sense of self are interconnected. So it's not that I don't think that there is such a thing. Probably, though, what is changing, and I think, you know, many people already feel this way, and including many non-scientists, that from the inside, of course, one doesn't think about all of these things as properties of the brain, but most people realize that they are just properties of the brain, and that it is, in a way, the brain's own way of talking about itself. It's the brain's own way of representing its own activities. And part of that representation doesn't carry the information, hey, and guess what, there's only a brain in here. It just is directed towards the external world and towards other people. So, of course, there is a difference between being aware of a stimulus and being unaware of a stimulus. And part of what we're interested in is what the difference in the brain is when you're aware, say, of being touched on the shoulder, and when you're not aware. Mm-hmm. What the difference in the brain is when you're awake and when you're asleep, or when you are under an anesthetic, or when you're fully alert. What's the difference when you're in coma and when you're not? And understanding those differences, I think, will give us a real perspective on what it is to be a conscious agent.
Connection Listeners, it's week 8 of our philosophy series. This is the mind-body philosophy of mind connection. You know you're a self, but do you ever hear a little voice saying, nobody in here but us neurons? 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. With Patricia Churchland and Antonio Damasio, Kathy is on the line.
Hi, this is a question for Patricia Churchland. Patricia, you're famous, you and Paul Churchland, for the idea that our folk psychological terms are just a theory that we collectively have built up to try to explain our own behavior and other people's behavior. I was wondering if you have any particular examples that help shed light on how our folk psychology might be changing as neuroscientists start to get their ideas out there and disseminating them to the general public. Like, for example, would our own perception of pain change as neuroscientists start to come up with new ideas about how pain works? Or even if, say, the caretaker of a patient with Alzheimer's, would the caretaker start to have sort of a different view of consciousness as they start to see how consciousness seems to be different in say, people with extreme Alzheimer's?
Interesting.
Yeah, that is a very beautiful question. And I do expect that there will be increasingly there will be surprises about the nature of the categories that we use currently to describe ourselves. I mean, one of the things that I think is very surprising about pain is that normally when you are experiencing a pain, it just feels like this thing and it's awful. And there is a kind of indissolvable hole to what you feel. And yet, it isn't really the way the brain does it. What we do now understand as a result of work by people like Antonio and others is that the sensation of pain is actually got several components, and one is the suffering part and one is the sensation part, and that they are sometimes dissociable. There are subjects who sometimes will feel the pain but not actually feel the suffering. Now, my guess is that is one example of a surprise to, so to speak, folk psychology, to the everyday way we have of understanding ourselves, and that there are others as well. I think increasingly we will understand ourselves as agents, able to make choices and able to make decisions in a profoundly different way from say how we did as recently as 10 years ago, and especially the work that's going on in Antonio's lab.
Well, Antonio, would you speak to it?
I mean, that conception of decision making, choosing what it is to be an agent.
Antonio, I think Kathy also wanted to know sort of the new language. We already have it in the sense that people say, you know, my serotonin must be down this month or something.
Yes, they do. Instead of talking
about their humors, how will it change the folklore, the vocabulary, the vernacular of moods?
Oh, I think it will change a lot. But, you know, it takes time. It takes time to absorb the new knowledge, integrate it, and create a new picture, a new conceptualization. And, you know, for instance, in relation to the notion of self, which you brought up several times, and Patricia as well, I think it's very interesting. You know, it used to be thought that when we were studying consciousness that we might have a chance of understanding how we have sort of a mind, how we have what I call in The Feeling of What Happens, the movie in the brain,
yes.
But that the idea of self would be absolutely out of bounds and that we would, you know, it would be sort of the core of the heart problem. We would never understand how it is that we have this sense of the me-ness in me. Well, as it turns out, and that's a surprise, I think it is far easier and it will be resolved far sooner, the problem of the self, that is, than the problem of the movie in the brain. And it's very interesting because we now have at least the beginning of a solution. And the idea is that in the movie itself, in this beautiful collection of patterns we're forming right now of auditory images and visual images and tactile images, there is something that emerges which is made of the same cloth. In other words, it is also made of images that literally gives you the sense that you own that mind.
Antonio Damasio, catch your breath. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about the intersection of philosophy and cognitive science on the question of your mind and your brain, your body and yourself. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston University, this is WB. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Week 8 of our philosophy series, The Mind-Body Problem, The Me-ness of Me, The You-ness of You. Who's running? Who's got the hand on the projector on the movie in your brain, Connection listeners? 1-800-423-8255. With the philosopher Patricia Churchland from the University of California at San Diego and the cognitive scientist Antonio Damasio at the University of Iowa. Antonio, you were just saying this is the hard problem, the self question that might never be solved. Why do you call it the hard problem?
Well, I don't call it the hard problem, but it is part of what has become known as the hard problem. And I don't think it is the hard problem, and I think it is actually the one that is going to be solved first. Mm-hmm. And what I was saying is that we know very well, all of us right now, that we have something going on in our organisms that we call the mind, which is really a very integrated collection of images of different sensory types. And you know, just think of the auditory images that you have right now, the visual images that you obviously have if your eyes are open, and the tactile images that you have in relation to the things you may touch on the table, for instance. But in addition to that, which is, of course, one of the fundamental problems we want to understand on the issue of consciousness, how is it that the brain creates those patterns? How is it that the brain integrates those patterns in time? And we are on the way to solving that problem without a question. There is another problem, which is how is it that I know, and you know, that that movie in your brain is shot in your perspective? How is it that you know that that movie is yours? How is it that you know that you can act as an agent on the contents of that movie? And of course, the traditional solution here is a very Cartesian solution, is that somehow there is something that is projected on a screen, or in the times of Descartes, was on a stage, and there was an audience. There was a viewer looking at that spectacle. The interesting thing is that there's no evidence whatsoever that there is a viewer that is separate from it, from the movie. Mm. What there is that inside the movie itself, we have information that is constructed, sort of new, freshly minted knowledge about the fact that there is an organism that is creating all of that. So you have knowledge that it is, that there is an individual, you have knowledge that there is in fact an organism, and you have that because at any given moment your brain is representing the entirety of your organism within itself. Mm. You have a representation, however, that is not at all the old homunculus that was this little person that would know all and that would interpret what was going on.
I'm glad you've introduced the perspective question. Patricia Churchland, do you want to comment on this hard problem matter? Do you accept this as the hard problem?
Well, I think there are many, many hard problems in understanding how nervous systems function. And, you know, it's very difficult to know in advance of solving a problem which is the harder and which is easier. And it is surprising, as Antonio has said, that quite a lot of progress has been made in understanding how it is that we have self-representations, how it is that you can have a brain that does this sort of self-referencing thing. And yet, many people, philosophers in particular, 50 years ago, 20 years ago, would have said that this was a hard, hard problem that could never be solved, that would require transcendental arguments and heaven knows what. And yet it looks like as the data come in and as we try to figure out what's going on, it is a problem that we will be able to solve. And I think the same thing about other aspects of awareness.
There are callers on the line ready to solve it. Patricia Churchland, Antonio Damasio, stand by. 1-800-423-8255, the mind-body philosophy connection. Leroy is in Vermilion, South Dakota.
Yes, I wanted to refer you back to an earlier program and connect it with the discussion of the moment when you had two speakers, Richard Rorty and Daniel Dennett, discussing philosophy of science, and they had, I think you may have been the one to bring up Thomas Kuhn, and it did seem to me that it's pertinent to raise the distinction between the view that Thomas Kuhn took of the nature of change in scientific...
Mr. Paradigm Shift, okay.
Yes, well, but more than that, just the whole sociological picture of the history of science in which there are these stages in scientific development that go through different kinds of first problem solving in particular. See, that's the terminology that's been used in this program for the moment. Dealing with alleged mind-body problem and a whole cluster of these things that are connected with it. And it seems to me when you look back to Descartes has this odd foundationalist picture of science where you're going to build a whole edifice of science. And the problem-solving terminology seems to me to lock in on... Well, on the one hand, it could just be the Cartesian picture, but in relation to Kuhn, it seems to be pertinent to those brief, I don't want to say brief, but those stages of what he might call normal science. And it seems to me, and I would like your speakers to try and...
I want to know from you, Leroy, though, is there a ghost in your machine or is it all machine?
Well, indeed there is, because in my personal, you see, there's a ghost in my machine only because I feel it, but that's not very helpful because... I'd be happy to find the worldview or come upon the worldview that your speakers are developing. You see, they're speaking in terms that sort of interact between science and philosophy, and I think it's a marvelous stage in the history of both science and philosophy. But I'm just thinking that the irony is that in speaking of problem solving, that is the language of the what Kuhn would call the normal.
I see.
Patricia,
yeah,
do you want to?
So your thought is, your question in a way is, are we at the stage where we're seeing a real revolution in how we understand these things, or are we in a period of normal science? Well, I think that's a hard question, to tell you the truth. and part of the reason is this, that within neuroscience, it's fair to say that we do not yet have a really well-established in-place framework that explains from the neurons all the way up to a system how things work. And we know that there are certain problems about getting that framework that we need to solve. On the other hand, we can, as Antonio pointed out, we can see bridges and threads now that are beginning to connect the level of the neurons on through the circuits and up to the systems and the whole brain. What I do see are a number of sort of small revolutions. How we think of the connection between neurons, the synapse, has changed profoundly in the last 20 years. Within, as it were, that small subfield of neuroscience, there certainly has been a revolution. How we think of circuitry and what circuitry can do has changed profoundly in the last 20 years. That's had a kind of mini paradigm shift of its own. How we think of systems and so-called centers is entirely different. We now realize that there can be specialization in the brain, but there aren't centers in anything like the way that there are modules in a computer, that there is tremendous sharing and interaction and so forth. What I see in neuroscience and cognitive science generally are a lot of mini paradigm shifts, but we are still not quite at the point of seeing how a big integrated framework is really going to pull it off.
That's fascinating.
And that's what's exciting, I think, about
neuroscience. How many minis does it take to make a maxi paradigm shift, Antonio?
I just don't know. Yeah, you know, I agree with Patricia. I think that we have it's in the nature of the problem, and I don't think that the Kuhnian stages are probably going to apply
because
what you. What you have is, by the way, when you see what has happened in neuroscience in the last quarter of a century, you know, I remember when the Society of Neuroscience was created in 1971, and there were about 1,000 of us, and right now there are over 30,000, and you just have this huge force of people who are working on many, many levels
of
the problem.
We might just nail it this hour. Stand by. 1-800-423-TALK. Mike is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Good morning. Thanks a lot for putting on such an interesting discussion.
Mike, thank you,
Mike. I actually have a two-component question here.
Two modules? Go ahead.
Yeah, unfortunately. First of all, I was rather struck by the fact that during the entire discussion, you folks veered very close to a fundamental problem, speaking from the position as a neuroscientist, that a lot of the thinking of us 30,000-strong neuroscientists are heavily dominated, and I think it started, frankly, well before 71, with the notion of what's basically embedded in complementarity and structures of large molecules. And at best, although we like to believe that using words such as integration and circuitry and all the rest, they've so far told us nothing new except about how the sensory system transmits, but absolutely nothing new at all about what we're using loosely, thought, self-awareness, self-perception. And the other, I'd like some comments about the need to find a new substrate. In other words, we can define the heart, we can define the liver from its properties, even its emergent properties, by understanding the molecules and the level at which they operate. But there's absolutely no relationship at all between the properties of any of the molecules that we understand today and the various capacities that we've been attributing to the performance, the emergent performance of the central nervous system. Do we need the equivalent of a Watson-Crick insight that gave us the foundation for modern genetics, which is the structure of DNA? And the second question has to do with Chomsky's speculation, I guess most recently in his book, New Horizons in the Study of the Language and Mind, that it's possible that the mind is unknowable. Now, as a neuroscientist, I'll listen. I don't happen to agree with Chomsky, but I'd be interested in the views of your guests.
Those are big names, Watson, Crick, Chomsky. Antonio, do you want to answer, Mike?
Sure, I can begin. Well, let's start with the last part of the question. Is the mind unknowable? You're not asking, is the mind unknowable? You're asking, is the relation between brain and mind unknowable? I think that to some extent it may be unknowable, because after all we're trying to understand something with the very organ that produces that thing, which is the brain. So I think that there's a part of it that might be out of bounds. However, I don't think that the majority of the problem is outside of scientific approach. I think it can be solved, but let's give it a doubt and say that yes, there may be a part of the problem that we may never reach, because we are using that same organ that we want to understand to understand. Mm. The idea that somehow we have not been able to make progress, and that what we know about brain and its circuitry does not connect with the thought process, I don't think is correct. I think that in fact we know quite a lot about very intimate relationships between different functions that have been well defined by psychology and the way brains operate at multiple levels. So there has been quite a lot of progress, and of course it would take a few hours to itemize all the progress. Mm-hmm. Now, do we need Francis Crick and Jim Watson to produce an equivalent discovery? I don't think so. I don't think it's going to be at that level, because the level is very different. Crick and Watson dealt with a fundamental discovery of the design of a molecule. We're dealing with something very, very complex, many orders of magnitude more complex, which has to do with the design of a whole brain in operation.
Hmm. Patricia, do you want to follow that?
That sounds reasonable. I mean, I'm always a bit nervous when somebody says something is unknowable. And I'm nervous about it because the history of science, of course, is very full of quite confident pronouncements to this effect, where it turns out not too much later that some, you know, brilliant graduate student or scientist emerges from the woodwork, and it turns out the problem is solvable. Not too very long ago, people said you would never solve the problem of the nature of life. And yet, on that particular issue, although there are outstanding questions, basically we understand how it is that things can be alive and the difference between living things and non-living things. So I'm very nervous, because to say something is unknowable is really to make a tremendous prediction, and it's to make a prediction about how science will develop from here on in.
We never
and
say
if
anything.
If there's anything we should have learned, it's that that's a rash prediction.
We have outstanding callers who know it all. 1-800-423-8255. Peter is on the line.
Yes, good morning.
Hello, Peter.
Hi. I tell the guests, and many others are making a logical category error. They talk as though by learning more facts about the body, eventually we'll learn more facts about the mind. But the mind is in a completely different logical category from the body. To give it a specific example, you might learn all kinds of interesting facts about our neurochemical reaction to green objects. But that's not going to ever tell you anything about our internal experience of the color green. I'll hang up and take the answers off the air.
Antonio?
Well, I think on the issue of category error, I would like to hear what Patricia says, although I don't think that that's the case.
But you're saying greenness is out there.
No. I think we are quite aware of the fact that there are, in fact, different categories of phenomena. My position is that when you talk about mind phenomena, I honor them entirely. I know that they're subjective phenomena. These are first-person entities, and yet I think that they are understandable biologically. I would agree with the caller that we have not reached the point in which we can specify all the characteristics of the biological phenomena that we call mind. But I believe that mind, which is a separate category, I agree, is biological and is biologically understandable.
But, you know, Patricia? The thing about categories is that sometimes categories can seem to be very separate But that embodies a hypothesis on our part. And sometimes what you do when you make progress is precisely to say, guess what? It turns out that temperature really just is the motion of molecules. Now, you might have said, well, temperature and motion are two really very different categories. And so on for many discoveries in science. So, you know, one man's category error is another man's scientific insight. And I think in this case, what we have is scientific insight, and we should just let the facts fall where they will.
Peter, thank you for raising the question. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. John is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, John. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to inject a little bit of Eastern thinking into this, because with all these new instruments, we're looking at the micro level. On a macro level, the Eastern philosophers, they see the world as finite, limited in space, relative and temporal, which is limited in time, which are all the qualities and qualifications of an illusion, whereas the definition of reality is the reciprocation of the world, which is not finite, which is not limited, and it's not relative, nor is it temporal. Hence, the brain is the interface between the absolute, real, and the finite world. And the chemistry of brain is like the software of a computer that changes our outlook and moods. And the actual flesh is like the hardware. And the computer, like the computer, is an interface between us and the internet. So there is a macro level which all of these new instruments kind of hide, which could enlighten the situation eventually.
I get the computer part, John. I don't get the Eastern philosophy part.
For example, the writings of Rumi, which become so famous, what they see the world is the world has the qualifications of an illusion. It's finite, it vanishes. Whereas all the qualifications of reality, which is absolute, is infinite and eternal, and therefore is not something that's temporal and disappears. So the brain is like the interface between the two worlds of reality, the infinite and the eternal, by definition, of reality, and the finite world. That's why they say if a human being has two eyes and a nose, then what's the difference between me and a picture on the wall?
Antonio and Patricia, do you want to make the Rumi Eastern connection here or not?
Well, I'm just a little bit puzzled. I mean, I'm not quite sure that my brain is an interface of the kind that he describes. I mean, I think my brain is sort of an interface between parts of my body and other parts, and between parts of my body and the world, and it's kind of all I've got to get around the world in. So I think there are interesting ideas that come out of Eastern philosophy, actually. Finally, in the last analysis, if what we're interested in is the nature of things and how we work, then you've got to put it to experimental test, and you've got to make it cohere with the rest of science. And I didn't quite get how that was going to work in this instance.
Did you, Antonio? Did you get it?
No, I didn't. But I think that's, you know, right now let's concentrate on our hypotheses, if we shall describe it that way, and see if it works.
One more caller, 1-800-423-8255. LB is calling from Fairfield, Iowa.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure, LB.
In the company of all these brilliant people, I should probably keep my mouth shut, but I did find one point I would like to pick up on. In all this discussion of the beautiful organization underlying these mechanisms that are being researched, one thing that comes up, and Mike, your previous caller, was getting at this beautifully, you never really see a correspondence between the physical manifestation and the underlying intelligence. Let me say, rather, there is a correspondence, but you never see the direct link. That is, you would never expect to find, for example, an intelligence molecule or an intelligence particle.
Yes.
Patricia?
Yes, quite. I do agree. It looks like intelligence or reasoning or perception of visual motion, if you like, are all really products of the interaction of neurons. So they are... They are not sequestered in an individual neuron. They are not sequestered in an individual protein. They are, in that sense, emergent properties. But I don't mean anything spooky by emergent in this sense. What I mean is that they are network properties. They are properties of the components and the particular way that they interact, which, of course, turns out to be very complex. But what, you know, Mike did make an interesting point, which I wanted to pick up on, and that is that we still really do not yet have an understanding of what information is for biological systems. We know that sort of Shannon Weaver approaches don't take us very far, but what we don't really yet have is a really deep understanding of what it is for neurons to carry information.
Patricia Churchland, we're just going to have to stay on the case and invite you back. Our language, our understanding, our paradigms of all of this mind-body stuff are changing, but let's think of it as a work in progress. Thank you, Patricia Churchland. Thank you, Antonio Damasio. Thanks, as always, to Connection Philosophers for calling. You can continue the mind-body conversation on our website at theconnectiononeword.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Broadvision, developers of personalized e-business applications, accepting e-resumes for release, and senior software engineers and managers. Mass jobs at broadvision.com. By 10,000.